510-848-6767, extension 621. That's 510-848-6767, extension 621. The community calendar is also available online at www.kpfa.org.
This is KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno. It's 12 noon. Stay tuned now for Against the Grain.
And today on Against the Grain, since September 11th and the unleashing of the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, many progressives have concluded that we're in a new political era, an age of empire. Radical thinker Jonathan Knitson, however, has a different take on how war and instability are profitable for capitalism, and I'll be joined by him after these news headlines with Mark Miracle.
The legal battle over same-sex marriage in California has resumed today in a San Francisco courtroom. A judge is hearing arguments in a pair of lawsuits that are seeking to have the state's marriage laws overturned. Shannon Minter, legal director for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, told the judge that the plaintiffs are regular people who work, pay taxes, volunteer, and raise children. They also just happen to be gay. The plaintiffs include the city of San Francisco and a dozen same-sex couples. They maintain that the law that defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman violates the state constitution. But the state attorney general is arguing to uphold the existing marriage laws, maintaining that they are part of an important tradition. The hearing began at 9:30 this morning and expected to last all day. U.S. forces sealed off entire districts of the Iraqi city of Mosul today, blocking bridges and raiding homes in a hunt for suspects after an attack that killed 18 Americans and four other people. FBI and other experts flown in from Baghdad were probing the cause of yesterday's lunchtime explosion at a U.S. base mess tent, the deadliest strike on Americans in Iraq. The military declined comment on a report they found the remains of a suicide bomber. If true, it would pose grave questions for security at U.S. bases as troops prepare to guard Iraq's election next month. Mosul's governor issued an overnight order on television banning the use of the five bridges over the River Tigris and said anyone breaking the order would be shot. Residents said Iraq's third largest city was a virtual ghost town with no one in the streets. A loud explosion hit the west of the city after dark. The cause not clear. The Red Cross says all four water purification plants in Fallujah are still not working after last month's U.S. offensive that left the city in ruins, complicating life for displaced families when they return. Representatives of the International Committee of the Red Cross said they visited Fallujah for the second time yesterday to assess the humanitarian situation there. Their first entry to the devastated city was on December 7th. The director of the Fallujah Water Board told the six-member all-Iraqi team that none of the treatment plants was operational. Last week, Iraq's interim cabinet announced that residents displaced by November's bloody U.S. campaign to retake the city will start returning to their homes. According to Iraqi statistics, 210,000 of Fallujah's 300,000 inhabitants fled when the invasion began on November 8th. At least 120,000 of them are in the nearby town of Amoria, while about 35,000 went to Baghdad. British Prime Minister Tony Blair offered today to host a one-day Mideast conference to help rehabilitate the battered Palestinian Authority, encourage reform, and serve as a bridge to renewed peace talks stalled by 4 years of violence. Blair, the highest-ranking visitor to the West Bank since Yasser Arafat's death, said a growing sense of hope must now be translated into action, while endorsing Israel's precondition for peace talks, an end to Palestinian attacks, and the Palestinian goal of an independent state. Despite Blair's peace push, violence persisted. Israeli troops entered the Khan Yunis refugee camp in southern Gaza after midnight for the second time in a week. As Israeli bulldozers flattened damaged structures, Soldiers exchanged fire with Palestinians, killing three, including two armed men. After nightfall, Palestinians said the Israelis were pulling out of the camp. Secretary of State Colin Powell reached out to Indonesia today to accelerate the pace of dealing with human rights violations committed during the 1999 violence in East Timor that killed 1,500 people. After Powell met in his office with Foreign Ministers Hassan Wirajuda of Indonesia and Jose Ramos Horta of East Timor, a senior U.S. official registered dissatisfaction with how Indonesia was proceeding. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan yesterday announced the creation of a Commission on Truth and Friendship and met privately with the two ministers in New York. The announcement came a month after the UN Security Council expressed concern with Indonesia's failure to punish those responsible for the violence that followed East Timor's vote for independence. News will return here on KPFA at 3 o'clock with Free Speech Radio News. News headlines again at 4. Please join us at 6 for the hour-long edition of the KPFA Evening News. Now stay tuned for Against the Grain.
You're listening to Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 or online at kpfa.org. My name is Sasha Lilly, sitting in for C.S. Song. It seems to go without saying on the left that we're living through a new age of imperialism. The Bush administration appears to have embarked on a process of endless war and military expenditure, starting with Iraq and Afghanistan and moving on to who knows where else, while racking up unprecedented levels of debt. The time seems ripe to dust off earlier theories of imperialism for insights into our time. But what if the era we're in, no matter how violent or repugnant, doesn't square with those theories? That's what radical Israeli scholar Jonathan Nitzan and his colleague Shimshon Bikler argue in a contrarian new work. They write, and I'm quoting, "The U.S. may be strong or weak, but it is not a capitalist empire. The capitalists who live there are decreasingly American in terms of what they own, and many of those who own American assets live elsewhere. The United States has no savings to export. It desperately needs those of other countries. U.S.-based capitalists do not unleash their government against other core countries, and when the U.S. does go to war, the purpose is neither conquest nor the exploitation of the conquered." Pretty provocative words for leftists, which Nitzan and Bikler are. Jonathan Nitzan teaches political economy at York University in Toronto and is the author of The Global Political Economy of Israel, published by Pluto Press, and most recently a work titled New Imperialism or New Capitalism. I'm joined by Jonathan on the phone from Toronto. Welcome to Against the Grain.
Hi.
So let's start with the fairly provocative argument that you make, provocative certainly to a lot of radical listeners, that the period we're in right now is not a period of imperialism. And you are someone who, I believe, sees yourself as being heavily influenced by Marxism, and Marxism in many ways shaped a lot of the arguments about imperialism. So start by telling us why it's not an age of empire.
It's interesting to note that until 2001, most of the debate on the left, as well as on the right, was about globalization, whether globalization was good or bad. And much of the so-called discourse on imperialism suddenly burst into life, more or less around September 11, Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that this debate itself is really misguided. The issue is really not globalization versus imperialism or globalization with imperialism. I believe that the issue really is to ask what type of capitalism we live in. And in fact, the issue is whether we have a new capitalism rather than a new imperialism. The concept of imperialism is a concept that reflects a reality that existed in the 19th century and the early 20th century, but I think that no longer represents the reality of the 21st century.
Can you lay out for us in a brief way, the sort of central thrust of these views, views that are associated with thinkers like Lenin and Hilferding and Rosa Luxemburg?
Yes. First, we need to make a distinction between imperialism and war. Just the fact that we have war in the Middle East doesn't mean that we live in a period of imperialism. Imperialism, traditionally in the turn of the century, had a fairly clear meaning, certainly for radical thinkers. I can perhaps list several of these features that I think are crucial. The first feature is that the imperialism that they observed was capitalistic, as opposed to non-capitalist empires that existed beforehand, and we had many of those. So their argument was that imperialism, capitalist imperialism, is driven by capitalists and more deeply by the necessity of the accumulation of capital. So that was a first assumption. The second assumption that they made was based on a very clear statist and geographical distinction between what they called core and periphery. So the leading capitalist states and the periphery of the world economy were clearly distinguished.
So in other words, the relationship between what we might think of as the rich countries and the poor countries.
You can phrase it in this way. The third characteristic was that there was ongoing territorial conquest of peripheral countries by core countries, and there was an ongoing war or a series of wars between the core countries themselves. So that's the third characteristic. And the fourth and perhaps the most important characteristic was that the driving force behind imperialism was A, the export of capital from the core to the periphery, and B, the exploitation of the periphery by the core. Now, I think that with the exception of the first assumption, namely that we live in a capitalist world, obviously we do, in fact, this is a stronger statement than ever to make, the other three conditions actually do no longer hold. So let me go through these distinctions again and see how they pan out in relation to the reality that we face presently.
Please do.
The first distinction between core and periphery. Just look at the United States. 20% of all U.S. assets, and that includes not only in the stock market, but everything that the statisticians consider to be an asset in the United States, roughly 20% are owned by foreigners. In fact, this is part of a larger picture in which ownership has become truly global. So in many ways, the distinction between core periphery is being contaminated in a very big way. Much of these assets are owned by other core countries, but increasingly also by so-called peripheral countries. So the sharp distinction that existed between core and periphery is compromised in a big way. Second, the notion of conquest of territory for the purpose of accumulation is gone. Iraq is not a country in which the U.S. accumulates in any significant way relative to the overall process of accumulation. We do no longer have wars between the leading capitalist countries. And now, very importantly, capital is not really exported only from the core to the periphery. It moves in all directions. I already mentioned that in terms of the geographical distinction, but we have massive capital inflow into the United States. The United States is the largest capitalist importer. So you ask yourself, what is the imperative of imperialism that existed in the 19th century? Does it exist now? And finally, and here we are getting into another issue altogether, the issue of exploitation. And here this connects to a theoretical question. Exploitation is based on a certain theory, and as far as Marxists are concerned, it is based on the labor theory of value. And that becomes a problem because this theory is really problematic, and therefore it is really problematic to establish the precise nature of that exploitation. I can just provocatively say that I cannot see how we can make a statement, for example, that the United States exploits India or exploits China. We have to be much more precise to be able to draw that conclusion. So my argument is that the overall characteristics that were used to describe imperialism in the 19th and early 20th century, these characteristics do no longer exist, and therefore it is really misleading to speak about imperialism without changing the term itself.
Well, in a minute, I'd like to break that down a little further and look at the labor theory of value. But before we go on, I'm sure there are listeners who are thinking that when you said, well, the U.S. doesn't significantly accumulate capital in its invasion of Iraq, that people would say, well, isn't that what Halliburton's doing? Isn't that significant?
Well, it is certainly significant for Halliburton. But if you think about the U.S. accumulation process as a whole, if you can even take the category of the U.S. at face value, you have to measure all the pluses and minuses for accumulation. And again, we'll talk hopefully about that later in the program. Maybe the consequences of that invasion are very negative for accumulation overall in the United States. So surely always any action that you can think of can serve some capitalists. But the question is, does it serve the dominant capital in the United States? And that's a different question altogether. I would say yes, but for reasons that are completely different than most people think.
Well, so let's zero in for a moment on the labor theory of value, which is fundamental to those classical Marxist theories of imperialism. And by the labor theory of value, you mean the idea that the value of a commodity is determined by the amount of labor required to produce it, correct?
This is really a landmine because there's been a huge literature on it, and a lot of people are going to have their ears, you know, kind of open when we start talking about it. It's as I said, a minefield. But let me just very briefly explain some of the features of that theory in point form. First, there is the assumption that there is something called abstract labor. So we can take any human activity that creates something, and we can argue that that human activity contains so many units of abstract labor, and we can therefore compare your activity to my activity and say, your activity contains 10 units of abstract labor and mine contains 5, say. So this is a fundamental assumption. And then the assumption is that, the second assumption is that every product, or every commodity rather, that is being produced contains a certain amount of abstract labor. And if you think about the average abstract labor that it takes to produce that commodity, that will be the value of that commodity. So say a glass could have 5 units, and a telephone set could have, say, 20 units, and then the ratio of them is going to be 4 to 1. And therefore, the argument is that prices in general, not always, and not always very precisely, but in general, movements of prices reflect, or movements of relative prices reflect, movements of relative values. So essentially, you're anchoring the entire architecture of the price system on the process of production, on the assumption that things derive their price from the productive activity. Now, we argue in the paper and elsewhere that the underlying logic of this theory is faulty, and that it actually does not enable us to work with this theory in any empirical way. And it, in fact, is no wonder that Marxists were never actually able to produce a statistical system based on value. And till this day, most of them use the standard accounting methods that are entirely neoclassical, entirely mainstream in their basis.
You just mentioned the neoclassical mainstream theory also of quantifying value, and that is the theory of utility. Can you explain what is problematic about that approach?
Yes, I think that the labor theory of value that goes back to the classical political economist and got its final shape from Marx, and the utilitarian neoclassical theory, they are fundamentally different in many important respects, but they also share a very common similarity. So while for Marx's labor theory of value, the fundamental substance was labor time, or abstract labor time, for the neoclassicists, the fundamental unit is unit of utility. So much like, just as, the Marxist would say that, an article, a glass, or a telephone contains so many units of abstract labor, a neoclassicist will say that it contains so many units of utility. The calculus of neoclassical economics is that, in that sense, is similar to the calculus of Marxist economics, in that it says that the ratio of prices, in principle, is proportionate to the ratios of utilities, as opposed to the ratios of labor, abstract labor time. Again, I'm not getting into the intricacies of the theories. Of course, it's much more complicated than that when you get to the details of it. But the gist of it is similar. You have a fundamental unit which is lying at the basis of the price system. In one case, it is labor value. In the other case, it's units of utility. And in both cases, this assumption goes to the substantialism of 18th century physics and chemistry, that believed in this notion of, law of conservation of matter, that basically matter does not disappear, it simply changes its form. So in Marx's theory, value changes its form as it is transferred from one commodity to the other. And in the neoclassical theory, the same thing happens. Utility changes its form when it moves from one commodity to the next, when one commodity is transformed to the next. And our argument is that both of these approaches are fundamentally impossible to work with. In other words, there are normative approaches, although they deny it very vehemently. They would argue that they are objective approaches. But we feel that, in fact, this is... both of them are based on a false pretense, and both of them are not really workable.
In fact, you write that both the liberal idea of utility and the labor theory of value have had historical roles to play, and I'm reading now, the first helped justify the rising bourgeois order, the second was a weapon to fight it. Both have run their course. So if that's so, how can we look at value?
Okay, well, this is where we propose an alternative approach that instead of using a labor theory of value or a utility theory of value, we offer a power theory of value. And that is based on a fundamentally different assumption. Whereas in the first two cases, you say the ratio of this fundamental unit, whether utility or labor value, is proportionate to the ratio of values. We do not say that there is such an equality. We say, on the one hand, there is power relations in society, and these power relations take or assume the form of relative prices. So we do not say that there is a quantitative correspondence between some unit that no one can see on the one hand, utility or labor value, and price that we can see on the other hand. We say there is, on the one hand, something we can see, these are prices. On the other hand, we have human institutions. And these human institutions, which under capitalism are power institutions, they determine relative prices. And this is what needs to be investigated.
And we'll get back to this way of looking at accumulation as the hour goes on. But I wanted to just step back for a second and connect this to the argument that you're making, which is that what we're experiencing now is not a period of imperialism, but a period of a new sort of capitalism.
Okay. Now, when I say that this is a new capitalism, it is new in the sense of being about 100 years old. It's only that now we begin to realize it. History changes and human beings realize that it does change, but they always tend to think of it with concepts borrowed from an earlier period. So it takes time until we adjust concepts or theories, and in this case, it has taken about, I think, a century. And there have been many attempts to try to figure out what has happened, and we think that in many cases they have gone in the wrong direction because they did not really discard the old assumptions. Now, let me try to get to the gist of the matter, doing not much justice to it, but at least trying to clarify where we start from. Perhaps the most important thing that has happened around slightly more than 100 years ago, and in the last decade of the 19th century was the transformation of capital into a financial form. So this, we think, is something that has altered the nature of capitalism. Capital, for the first time in history, became totally vendible. In other words, something you can buy and sell anytime, anywhere, in any proportion. Me and you can pick up the phone today and buy Indian equities of any quantity. We can buy part of a corporation. We can buy the whole corporation. We can do it at any time in the day, in any country, and with no problem. Now, the vendibility of capital is not new, but what is new is that this is a system that now dominates the way that capitalism operates. Now, from a historical standpoint, this transformation of capital into finance, and only finance, so we argue that all capital is finance, rather than the usual distinction into productive capital and financial capital and commercial capital, we think that all of it is financial. This transformation had enormous implications to the way that capitalism operates. First, the vendible nature of finance enabled a massive politicization of capital, and that's crucial. It enabled, first, the emergence of the giant corporation, because then you can easily fuse an endless number of owners, and you can defuse them and fuse them in any way you want. Secondly, it enabled the emergence of the giant corporate coalition. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, it enabled a certain fusion between capital and state, which was not possible beforehand. Now, clearly, this type of politicization of capital means that we need to understand accumulation in terms of power. And here we go back to this discussion we had of neoclassical economics and Marxian economics, that the theories of accumulation that exist until now are theories that leave no room for power because they are anchored either in production or in consumption. And that creates a huge fracture.
Well, let me just jump in here for a minute.
Yes.
I think there are a lot of people who would argue that the idea of economics in Marxism is very much that of political economy, of the politicization of economics. In other words, the ties between power and wealth are fundamental to Marxism.
That is correct. Marx, in his entire life, and that is probably to his greatest credit, insisted that you cannot understand politics separately from economics, that the two are fused together. And in fact, capitalism was the dominant political form in our society. However, having said that, his analytical framework of capitalism got locked into a problem. And the problem was that the units of capital, which he framed, were units of abstract labor anchored in production. So although the purpose of Marxist theory was to repoliticize the economy against Adam Smith that tried to depoliticize the economy, he ran into a problem. And the problem was that his analysis was basically held back by his basic substantialist concept of what constitutes value. So I agree with you completely that Marx had the right purpose. He just went in the wrong direction. Now let me try to continue here in terms of the fracture that was created. The theory that uses material categories has to then bring in power. And how do you do that? Well, you do that by saying that there are distortions, that things do not work as they are supposed to work, because then politics intervenes. And that is what both neoclassicists do when they say, well, in an ideal world, we have perfect competition and everything works according to the simple model of supply and demand, but then we don't live in that ideal world. We have politics that distorts everything. And many Marxists do the same thing by saying there is a method of expanded reproduction, but then that method doesn't work because there are distortions. And those distortions create something like primitive accumulation or dispossession, accumulation by dispossessions, etc., etc. All of them are basically distortions and deviations from the pure model. So as long as you stick to a notion in which capital is something productive, something material, something that has to do with energy expended or energy consumed, you are never going to be able to integrate power into the framework in a consistent way. And we think that this mold needs to be broken, that we need to start from power, not to tuck in power as we go along, because then you are forever going to have a fractured theory.
And you're listening to Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 FM or on the web at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, sitting in for C.S. Sung. My guest today is York University professor Jonathan Knitson. He's written a number of works about oil, capitalism, and war, including The Global Political Economy of Israel. We're talking today about the arguments he and his co-author, Shimshon Bichler, have laid out in a new manuscript titled New Imperialism or New Capitalism. Well, let's talk a little more about this issue of how we conceptualize production. For many radicals, as you've basically alluded to, production is central, certainly for Marxists. And the idea is that for capitalists to accumulate more capital, they need to produce more goods to sell them, to then take in more profits, and then they reinvest them in order to make more goods. That's the central form of accumulation for Marxism. But you're arguing that production is not the central force of accumulation. So can you explain that for us?
Let me try to be more precise. I'm not saying that production is not central to accumulation. What I'm saying is that accumulation represents not production, but represents power over production. And that's a fundamental difference. So not only Marxists, but also neoclassical economists believe that more production is equivalent to accumulation, more or less. So economic growth and accumulation are almost considered a synonym because they have a materialistic or substantialist notion of what capital is. Now, we are saying that the production process is something that you control, that accumulation is, if you like, a numerical architecture, a price architecture that dominates the productive process, directs the productive process. And when we say production, we mean more than the production line. We mean the entire, if you like, human endeavor. But knowing that production process itself tells us very, very little about the quantitative nature of accumulation. So we cannot, as Marx believed and as the neoclassicists believe, start from production, understand the quantities of production, either in utility terms or in labor value terms, and from that build the building of accumulation. No. We have to start with accumulation and understand how accumulation shapes production. But production in many ways is a qualitative process that does not have the quantities necessary to understand accumulation. Let me give you an example, just to kind of intuitively indicate what I have in mind.
Please do.
If you take two companies that I suppose all Americans know the names, one is Microsoft and the other is General Motors. The first one, Microsoft, has a market capitalization of, say, these are roughly accurate numbers, perhaps not to the day, of about, say, $300 billion. And General Motors has a market capitalization of $25 billion. Now, what accounts for this difference in the size of their capital when we measure it in dollars and cents? This is the size of their assets on the stock market. Now, let's look at General Motors. It has about 300,000 workers. It has massive plant and equipment all over the world. And it has a hugely complicated production process, one of the most complicated you can think of. Now, compare that to Microsoft. It has only 50,000 workers. It has very little equipment to speak of. And it has a fairly simple production process. It produces software, and many other companies produce software that is not inferior, in many cases, probably superior to Microsoft's. So in terms of the tangible assets, the picture should be the reverse of what it is. We should have, in fact, General Motors having a much bigger capitalization, but it doesn't. So the conventional views, both mainstream and radical, I believe, explain this mismatch in different as a form of distortion. For example, they might say, look, the stock market is simply inflated or deflated. In other words, there's too much hype around Microsoft and too little hype around General Motors, and therefore we have this difference. Or you can say that, yes, Microsoft does not have plenty of equipment, but it has a lot of human capital. Now, of course, these are irrefutable statements. You can never refute those things because nobody can measure hype and nobody can measure human capital, as far as I know. Now, I think that the problem with these explanations is that all of them go back to the initial assumption that there must be something tangible about capital, and then if it doesn't work, then it becomes a distortion. Now, we take a completely different view. We argue that the capitalization of these two companies, like any other company, or like any other asset for that matter, represents essentially two things. It represents A, anticipated earning power, and B, it anticipates anticipated risk. Now, both of these factors have little to do with production in any quantitative way, and everything to do with power. And let me just illustrate that briefly. I don't want to drag the answer too long, but in the case of Microsoft, it's very, very simple. Think of what will happen if tomorrow the U.S. government is going to announce, of course it will not announce it, but suppose it were to announce that intellectual property rights do no longer exist. Now, whether Microsoft has good or bad products, regardless of how long or how little it takes to produce those products, the profits and capitalization of Microsoft are going to collapse to zero immediately. In other words, the only reason Microsoft, in this case, makes a profit, and the only reason it has this huge capitalization, is the power of the state. I'm not saying that production does not count here, but what turns this production into profit and what turns this profit into capitalization is the power of the state that Microsoft is able to harness. In other words, we need a theory of power in this case. So if you look at relative prices, essentially what you look at is at relative powers. And the process of accumulation is a process of constantly changing the power structure in society. And that is to do partly with production. Certainly production is a mechanism through which power is accumulated, decumulated, gained or lost. But not only production, many other things. For example, a war can be a mechanism that affects relative prices and therefore affects accumulation. Inflation can do the same thing. Almost any phenomenon that we can think of becomes a facet of accumulation if we can understand it in terms of power.
Well, let's talk about inflation, which you just mentioned. We hear, including from the mouthpiece of big business, The Economist magazine, that inflation is bad for business because it means that capitalists are paying higher wages to workers, and that businesses that have a lending dimension get burnt also by inflation, since it reduces the real amount debtors end up paying them back for their loans. Uh-huh. Central banks, according to this view, are invested in keeping inflation low, even if it ends up stifling economic growth, as many have argued has been the case in Europe and has kept that economy from growing. So this tends to be an argument one hears, that inflation couldn't be good for business. Why would it be good for business?
First, just a historical note. If you examine the history of inflation, we have quite detailed statistics, for instance, about the United Kingdom. In the 20th century alone, they have gone up by about 5,000%. So this presents a very interesting dilemma, because it suggests that the most capitalist period of all, the 20th century, has been a disaster for business because it's been so inflationary. Obviously, it hasn't been disastrous for business, and then the question is, perhaps there is something in inflation that is not always that bad for business. And here I would take a step further and say, well, inflation is not a phenomenon. Inflation is an entire regime. In fact, for those people who were born in the 20th century, they can almost not imagine a world in which prices do not rise. They always rise. When we say deflation, what we mean is that prices rise less slowly. Sometimes, of course, there are exceptions, like in Japan recently, etc. But in general, the 20th century is always inflationary. So this is a regime. And the inflation regime is one in which prices generally rise. But what is so interesting about that process is that prices never, ever, with only one exception, do not rise at the same rate. They always rise at different rates. The only exception is if you put a freeze on all prices, so they do not rise at all, and then the common rate of increase is zero. But if there is inflation, prices oscillate around it. Some rise more slowly and some rise more rapidly. And the question then is, who benefits and who loses? Because if your prices rise faster than inflation, obviously income is redistributed in your favor. And the question is, who benefits, as I said, who loses, and whether we can actually find a systematic pattern. And not too many people actually investigate that question. The bias from 19th century theory, both radical and conservative, is that, again, inflation is some sort of a distortion to the system. It's something that occurs but shouldn't occur, and it is most of the time neutral. And even if it is not neutral in terms of its effect, it's something that is secondary to the question of production. Accumulation is about production. But if you actually try to investigate the process empirically, you see very interesting patterns. For instance, in the United States, if you look at the ratio of profits, of earnings per share, so if you're an owner of stocks on the stock market, your claim on corporate earnings is measured by a so-called indicator called earnings per share. You take the ratio of earnings per share to the wage rate. So the first measure is a measure of the earnings of a capitalist, and the second is a measure of the earnings of a worker. This ratio between these two magnitudes is actually very correlated with inflation. When inflation is rising, usually capitalists benefit relative to workers and vice versa. Now, this is not a natural law. It is a reflection of power. And when capitalists are more powerful, then that will be reflected in inflation being in their favor. When they're less powerful, the opposite is going to happen. And sometimes it does happen in the opposite direction. For example, during the 1960s, or in many European cases where labor is relatively more powerful and therefore more organized to fight for its share, then you see inflation actually panning in favor of labor. But in most cases that we have investigated, and we looked at Latin America, we looked at Russia, we looked at Israel and the United States, among others, inflation usually redistributes income from labor to capital, and furthermore, it redistributes income from small firms to large firms. And these patterns, and our works actually detail them with great empirical evidence, these patterns seem to be quite persistent. So the argument that inflation is bad for business needs to be made with care and supported with evidence. I don't accept it. At the same time, I wouldn't make a blanket statement that it always is good for one side and bad for the other side. It is a question of power. There are many reasons to not want inflation, although it redistributes income from the less powerful to the more powerful. It has other side effects that make it, if you like, a second best type of accumulation strategy.
And that's the voice of political economist Jonathan Knitson, who joins us by phone from Toronto. You just mentioned that capitalists have better ways of accumulating, and you and your co-author make a distinction between accumulation through breadth and accumulation through depth. Can you explain what these two categories are and how they work?
Yes. We first start by saying, because we want to develop a power theory of capital, we focus not on capital in general. When we deal with the politicization of accumulation, then we deal with a fairly cohesive ruling class, ruling capitalist class. So therefore, we talk about dominant capital, about the leading coalitions that are made of the largest corporate state alliances. So our focus is really not on the corner grocery store as your typical capitalist, but on the largest conglomerates and the state institutions that are associated with them. Now, what we found, and I think that we are the only ones to have researched that that process, because we have a different power theory rather than utility or value theory. We looked for processes that are not associated with production necessarily, and we found that there are actually two dominant processes that completely overshadow the production processes, the engine of accumulation for the large dominant capital groups. And we call that differential accumulation. In other words, it is the accumulation of the large groups, the large capitalist groups, relative to the average. And these two paths or regimes, we call them, as you mentioned, one was breadth and the other was depth. So let me speak about each of them briefly. The assumption that more production, greater growth, and so on leads to more accumulation has very little impact on the differential accumulation of the large firms. In other words, their ability to grow in terms of the profits faster than the average. You have, as a capitalist, you have two choices. You can either build a new factory, or you can buy this factory by buying a company. So the factory of somebody else, you can buy it, and that gives you that capacity. Instead of building it new, you buy it from others. Now, I'm saying that in the turn of the century, the ratio of money put into mergers as opposed to money put into new capacity was less than 1%. There was almost no merger activity relative to new capacity. If you go all the way to the end of the 20th century, for every dollar of new capacity, there were more than $2 put into mergers and acquisitions. So there has been an enormous growth in merger activity relative to so-called real investment. And that has been the major engine of differential accumulation. That has been the source of the growth of the largest businesses in the world, not only in the United States, but everywhere in the world. The way that large firms grow is by buying other firms, not by building new capacity. And that has been one engine of differential accumulation that we have identified. We also identified the inflationary process as an engine of differential accumulation. As I explained earlier, inflation is a process of redistribution, of restructuring, and it turns out that in most of the cases, again, not always, but it works in favor of large firms versus small firms. So again, it's an engine of differential accumulation. And what we also found, and that's the most fascinating aspect of it, is that these two regimes are actually moving as mirror images of one another. In other words, they are counter-cyclical. When you have a rise in merger activity, then you have a decline in inflation. And when merger activity collapses, then you often have an increase in inflation as if to compensate. Now, let me just put it in context. This is completely opposite or completely contrary or orthogonal, if you like, to conventional approaches that argue that business is about producing more and that business loves price stability and hates inflation. This picture shows quite a different type of pattern.
And how do these cycles that you've just mentioned, how do they relate to recent history that we can understand? At what periods have these regimes of breadth and depth been dominant?
Over the past century, there were about four distinct waves of merger activity. We had one in the beginning of the century when the big business just began to emerge. We had so-called oligopoly merger movement of the 1920s when firms became integrated within sectors. And then in the 60s, we have another merger wave that is called the conglomerate merger wave, in which firms started to diversify in different directions and go into different lines of business. And then in the 1980s and 1990s, we have the so-called, what we call the global merger wave, which is associated with what people like to call neoliberal globalization. Now, each of these waves collapsed at some point, and all of these collapses were followed by a period of inflation, and in fact, a period of stagflation. In other words, inflation together with stagnation. We see that Following the 1920s, we have, of course, the Second World War and the massive stagflation that occurred in the 1930s. We have, again, the collapse of the global merger wave, the conglomerate merger wave in the 60s. We had the stagflation of the 1970s and early 80s. And what we argue is that in the beginning of the 20th century, we are facing another similar crossroads in which a long merger wave, in fact, the longest and largest merger wave, the global merger wave, has collapsed, and we are seeing the beginning signs of stagflation returning. Now, we are just in the beginning of this process. We are dealing here with long history. So we are dealing here with cycles that are perhaps 20 or 15 years in length, so it's hard to judge whether this is just a blip or the beginning of another type of, you know, declines in mergers and rise in stagflation. But we have predicted this coming in 1998, so it's quite fascinating to see it beginning to happen. Not very encouraging, though.
So this transition that we have recently experienced between the end of this period of mergers and the emergence of what you see as a period probably of stagflation is also tied in many ways to the end of one political regime, that is the dominance of the Clinton administration and the rise of Bush, certainly following September 11th. How does the policies of the Bush administration tie in, if it does, with your theory?
Yes. I haven't said it so far. I just kind of slipped it in, but not explicitly. But inflation tends to, in fact, and this is, again, one of the big lies of the economics profession, that it argues that inflation is positively connected with growth. The greater the growth, the greater the inflation, and vice versa. In fact, if you look at the history of the 20th century in the United States, or the last 50 years in the industrialized countries, or individual countries, both developed or developing, you'll find the opposite being the case. In other words, inflation is negatively, in most cases, correlated with economic growth. In other words, when we have inflation, usually we have stagflation, stagnation plus inflation. And economists tend to, primarily mainstream economists, tend to treat that as an anomaly. But in fact, it is not an anomaly. It is the rule. Now, as it turns out, this type of crisis is often necessitating a period of political instability and political crisis. In order to be able to see prices starting to rise and to have an inflationary spiral, you need some sort of a catalyst. You need some sort of a conflict in society that has some sort of a crisis associated with it. And in fact, the previous cycles of stagflation were associated precisely with such political turmoil. So we had the First World War associated with stagflation, we had the Second World War associated with it, and we had the period of the 70s and 80s that were massive wars in the Middle East. So what we see now is pretty consistent with that picture. We see a fundamental shift in U.S. policy, so it seems, from a policy dominated by rhetoric of the global village and global capitalism and massive tearing down of barriers, to a period in which you have war and terror, and either you are with us or against us, and we are going to spread democracy, etc. We are moving into a period of evidently prolonged conflict in the Middle East, and perhaps not only in the Middle East, and that is fairly consistent with what we see, the beginning of the return, possibly, of stagflation. So, to your question, the change in policy in the U.S. administration, the move from the Clinton era to the Bush era, is actually very consistent with this type of change in the regime of accumulation. Now, if you start from a standard political economy approach, this seems pretty inconsistent. It seems as if Bush is shooting himself and all his friends in the foot.
So just to make sure I've got your argument right, you're arguing that in a period of stagflation, that it's actually in the best interest of business or least dominant capital to actually have instability in war.
Well, let me put it a little bit more precisely. I think that the dominant capital would much prefer to have the merger boom continue. However, the merger boom has fizzled and crashed, in fact, in the beginning of the 21st century. And then there were two choices, either to accept differential decumulation or to offer the alternative strategy of stagflation, which is highly beneficial but also much more risky, as we have described. So I think this is what is developing right now, and it is a half-hearted movement, but nevertheless it seems to be taking place.
So you were actually on this program a year and a half ago. You were on a week after the U.S. invaded Iraq, and at that time people on the left were making the argument that it was a war for oil, particularly for cheap oil, and that once the U.S. invaded Iraq, that oil prices would fall. At the time, you said that the opposite would happen, that in fact they would rise, and of course, oil prices have risen.
Yes, this was not just a guess or just a prediction of an analyst. It was, as I suggested, part of a larger theory of what accumulation was. And at the time, I think that prices just fell from something like $30 or $32 just heading towards the war, and they were about $28 and falling, and everybody thought that, or argued that, essentially the U.S. is moving towards making oil cheap, and that goes back to what we mentioned before about the two theories of value, the labor theory of value and the utility theory of value, which believe that accumulation is synonymous with growth, and in order to have growth, you need to have cheap oil, and oil is in the Middle East, and the Middle East is problematic, so if need be, you go and settle things and make sure that oil is plenty and inexpensive. And we argue that dominant capital presently needs stagflation to compensate for the collapse of mergers and acquisitions, and therefore it needs higher oil prices, because higher oil prices have been traditionally a spark for inflation. And the entire purpose, whether intended or just a latent reason for the invasion, is to make the region more unstable, or look more unstable, to make oil look more scarce, and to enable this movement towards greater instability and stagflation. I think we were correct on that.
And I've been speaking with Jonathan Knitson. He's co-author of a number of works with his collaborator Shimshon Bichler, including the book The Global Political Economy of Israel, and most recently the manuscript New Imperialism or New Capitalism. Listeners can go to our website, againstthegrain.org, where they'll find links to that work and other writings by Knitson and Bichler. Thanks so much, Jonathan, for being on Against the Grain.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Sung and Sasha Lilly. Please visit our companion website, againstthegrain.org. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209.
I'm Eileen Alfandari. Every night at 6 o'clock, join me, Mark Miracle, Wendell Harper, and the rest of the KPFA news team for in-depth alternative coverage of the day's events. International, national, state, and local news on the KPFA Evening News on 94.1 FM.
You're listening.